You're listening to the End of Sport podcast, a podcast about harm, labor, and inequality in capitalist sport with your hosts, Johanna Mellis, Nathan Coleman-Lamb, and Derek Silva. The End of Sport podcast is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network, your left podcast community. Find us in great company with over 60 other shows at harbingermedianetwork.com. And as always, if you're enjoying the show, please feel free to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform and please leave us a 5-star review, as those always help us reach a wider audience. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy this episode of The End of Sport.
Hi, friends, and welcome to another episode of The End of Sport podcast. My name is Nathan Coleman-Lamb, and today I have an episode for you that will really be a compliment for an earlier episode we had with Raewyn Connell talking about masculinity, hegemonic masculinity, and beyond. And today, in this episode, what I want to do is actually drill even deeper into the concept to lay out for you what hegemonic masculinity means as an analytic lens for understanding gender, but also the sociology and cultural studies of sport more particularly. And then also introduce the concept of inclusive masculinity, which has been offered as a kind of rebuttal to or replacement for hegemonic masculinity as a lens for understanding the role of masculinities in sport today. And I have the great pleasure of being joined by Colleen English and Daniel Salofsky, who are really perfect interlocutors for walking through what hegemonic masculinity means, how it has been challenged by inclusive masculinity, and also why we see some limitations in inclusive masculinity theory for the ways in which it tries to counter hegemonic masculinity, which is to say that we see a continued relevance for hegemonic masculinity as a lens for understanding gender and sport. I hope this conversation serves both as a good introduction to hegemonic masculinity for those less familiar with the concept, and also as a kind of really nice, effective deep dive for those who are more familiar with the concept already and want to hear some analysis about the value of the concept and how it comes into conversation with inclusive masculinity. It is impossible to adequately introduce my guest today, who is essentially the founder of the field of masculinity studies. Raewyn Connell is Professor Emerita at the University of Sydney and author of the selected and incredibly abridged list of books, Gender and Power, Masculinities, The Men and the Boys, Gender, and in 2023 with Melbourne University Press, Research, Politics, and Social Change. Again, among an exceptionally long list of other texts I have not mentioned that have come to shape the academy really in so many ways as we know it today. I'm so honored to have you join me on the show, Raewyn. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Okay, well, you have had a remarkable career in no small part because your scholarship has shaped this entire field of study, masculinity or masculinities. Given the central role of masculinities in sports culture, this means your work has profoundly shaped the sociology and cultural studies of sport. To begin, and this is obviously really an enormous question to begin with, so you can kind of go with it as you please, but I would love it if you could explain for listeners the concept of hegemonic masculinity you originally developed and how your thinking about masculinities has developed over time.
Sure, we can do that. I think the concept of hegemonic masculinity emerged actually from research in schools, which I was doing with some colleagues in Australia. We were looking at social inequality in schools, and that included gender questions, though it was originally mainly about class differences. But we became aware in the course of interviewing, 14, 15-year-old kids in some detail, and also their families and their teachers, members of their peer groups, that there were different kinds of masculinity around. Masculinity wasn't a single thing. There were rather multiple masculinities, in fact, even in the small world of the school. And nevertheless, there was overall a gender order, a set of social arrangements that we call gender relations in the society as a whole, which somehow incorporated different patterns of masculinity. And this set us off thinking, what's the significance of these differences? And came to the conclusion that this is part of what, in a way, stabilizes gender inequalities in the society as a whole. So the notion of hegemonic masculinity was really about identifying the version of masculinity that had, if you like, top prestige, had most respect, and which also embodied the privileges of men in the society as a whole. So therefore it had a role in producing and then sustaining gender inequality. And the term hegemony particularly means not just power or privilege, but it means power and privilege exercised through what we might think of as culture, through language, through identities, through sports and entertainment, that kind of thing. So it's not the same concept as toxic masculinity or something like that, which usually refers to something involved in physical abuse or violence of some kind. Another thing we became conscious of quite early was the idea that hegemonic masculinity, like any other kind of masculinity, could change over time. There could be, in a way, contestations for hegemony between different patterns of masculinity. In fact, we saw that in particular school contexts actually happen. For instance, conflicts for prestige and respect between the guys who were good at football, who were representative of a somewhat older model of privileged education, and guys who were good at academics, who were, if you like, carrying the school's prestige in the competition for exam results and access to university and so forth. So you could see actually a kind of struggle going on in a particular school. And then, of course, we can think about that happening on a much larger scale in the society as a whole. So that's where I started with this concept, how it originally came into being. And that's a little odd because we started, if you like, with a kind of synthesis of ideas about gender and masculinities. And it was only after that that I set out deliberately to study versions of masculinity and began doing that through life history research by interviewing people in some depth about their lives and getting an understanding of not just of their current practices of masculinity, but how those practices have come into existence over their lifetime. So that was for me a kind of phase of empirical studies, which I got into in the later 1980s, and then later I did interviews of that kind in a number of other countries. Again, doing it with managers in the corporate world, in the public sector, and so forth. So there was a stage, if you like, where my colleagues and I and many other researchers around the world too were adding sort of empirical detail to the study of masculinity. And then in the third stage, which I guess is still the stage my work has been in, I've been trying to rethink the material that came out of those empirical studies in the context of a larger view of knowledge and global inequalities, which produced a book of mine called Southern Theory, where I look at social analysis as actually come out of the global south, that is the majority world, rather than the old imperial centres of the global north. And thinking of the history of masculinity, not just in terms of the conventional history come out of Europe and North America, but in a global context, thinking, for instance, of the role of colonization, colonialism, empires in the making of modern gender orders in the majority world rather than just in the global north. And that, of course, has led me into a very interesting reading of work from Latin America, from South Asia, from the Arab world, from Africa, from East Asia, and so forth, and just beginning to get a sense of the way these issues might play out on the largest possible scale. So plenty of work still to do for me, I guess. I'm not bored.
No, not at all. So that's incredibly helpful. And it leads me to my next question, which is sort of, given that in October of 2016, at that time, future President Donald Trump in the United States infamously referred to a recording of profoundly misogynistic and violent comments he had made as locker room banter. Many in the sports world at the time pushed back on those claims, suggesting he was in a way besmirching the reputation of the locker room. And that reaction was to an extent in keeping with what I would say was a new academic kind of theoretical intervention that emerged around the same time in the work of Eric Anderson and others proclaiming the rise of inclusive masculinity in sport, suggesting that the homophobic or homohysteric, to use Anderson's term, climate in sports culture had shifted towards new and inclusive norms, such that even when homophobic and misogynistic slurs are explicitly employed, and now I quote, they do not unanimously intend for it to be interpreted as homophobic. Now, as my own students have pointed out in class, the use of these slurs in the locker room is unequivocally intended to connote something bad or undesirable, such that it is difficult to see how their use can be construed as anything other than homophobic or misogynistic. My own research and experiences in and around locker rooms, masculine sport and cultures, strongly suggest that inclusive masculinity is more aspirational exception than rule today. I'm curious just how you've read this. Have we entered a new era in which inclusive masculinity has become in some way hegemonic? And perhaps more generally, to what extent are you satisfied with the ways in which the field and studies of masculinities have developed and evolved?
Well, on that particular interpretation, I would have to say that it assumes a succession, if you like, between hegemonic masculinity and inclusive masculinity, which is really a misconception of what the idea of hegemony and hegemonic masculinity is about. It's not the name of a particular unchanging toxic model of masculinity. It's a term for, if you like, the masculinity that develops in a particular setting, in occupying a particular place and role in the gender order as a whole. And it changes, and as I said before, there can be conflicts for the hegemonic position, and differently formulated masculinities may become and do in historical time do become hegemonic. Now, it'd be lovely to think that that has happened now in such a way that really nice guys now have the dominant position in this particular cultural field, and that the arms are stretched out to welcome our homosexual brothers into the fold. But I fear that is, to the extent that's happened, it's very localized. At the same time, of course, new patterns of homophobia and aggression have appeared on the cultural and political scene and have become very, very conspicuous. So if there is a conflict for hegemony going on at the moment, I think it's got a very different shape from what those ideas suggested. In terms of how the field of study of masculinities has developed, that's interesting and complicated, as you might expect. About 30 years ago, I guess, the field of research was going global at a considerable rate of knots. In fact, there had been important thinking and debates about masculinity in the global south beforehand, before the field of social research on masculinity emerged in its current form in the 1980s. So there had been debates for decades across Latin America about the idea of machismo, about the prominent position of a culture of masculine assertiveness and domination over women in that part of the world. There are very interesting discussions too coming out of India about the impact of colonialism on masculinities in India, and indeed on the colonizers too, which is an important point. And believe it or not, in Iran, you know, which we think of, it's easy for people in the Anglosphere to think of as a backward-looking, conservative country. Well, in the 1960s, it produced one of the first critical analyses of masculinity in a kind of neo-colonial situation that anywhere in the world. So, you know, there's been lots of global debate about these issues. Actual social research also went global very much in the 1990s. We began to get new empirical studies of men and masculinities from all those parts of the world, which obviously then added complexity to our thinking. We couldn't simply export models of masculinity or of gender relations from the Anglosphere to other parts of the world and just assume they would be the same. We now have to think about interactions on a very large scale between gender dynamics in different parts of the world, mediated through, you know, 100 years ago through empires, now through international institutions, global markets, transnational corporations, global media, and of course the academic world. So that's perhaps the most important way that the field has changed. But there are also other important developments. One is recognizing that masculinity is not just in individual people's heads, but can be embedded in the way a particular institution works. So there are there are very interesting studies of masculinized institutions, such as military forces, and of course, commercial sports also. And we're now at a point where, if you like, if there's going to be a next big, so I think it's going to have to deal both with the way masculinity and femininities too work in institutional contexts in organizations, multinational corporations, global markets, military forces, governments, and the like, but also which reckon with cultural difference and the long-term effects of empire, colonization, slavery, and the dire part of what has produced the modern world. That will be part of our tasks in thinking about masculinity from now on. So I think there's interesting times ahead, as well as the interesting times we've already had.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And that's a remarkable sort of tour through this sort of history of masculinity studies that you've taken us on now, and incredibly appreciate it. When I talk to students in a sociology of sports class, one of the issues I really like to engage them on is the question of how masculinities operate as a set of normative expectations in the context also of women's sport, right? Because, of course, the tension, and I think that this is so many of the, especially so many of the women in my classes who are athletes, because often my, so, you know, sociology, of course, is a sport class to have athletes take it, that they have this very challenging situation where norms of femininity and masculinity are operating on them in the same moment, right? So I'm curious, to what extent would you say that hegemonic and other masculinities, other iterations of masculinity, condition the culture of women's sports and produce these complex dynamics and challenges in terms of identity for participants?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, and you can see it happening. You know, hegemonic masculinity, or indeed any other kind of masculinity, is not necessarily tied to XY male bodies. I mean, we know that because there are transsexual men. We know that there has long been discussion, you know, going back in Europe, at least to the 1920s, of, you know, masculinization of women or of groups of women who bear some of the characteristics called masculine. There have been lesbian subcultures where that's present. Organizational settings. And we'll go back another 100 years, you found, you know, women digging in the mines. And our current conventions about what's acceptable, you know, masculine and feminine occupations have changed historically. We think of the Industrial Revolution as having been carried forward by hairy-chested men, and indeed most of the owners of the factories of men. But in the early factories, a very high proportion of the workforce was actually women and children. So these things change. It's not at all surprising to find, you know, the elements of a hegemonic configuration of masculinity working in the institutional context of women's sports. And I would say particularly women's commercial sports, because there have been mass participation sports that were almost entirely women's, which were amateur, which were not under the competitive and individualizing pressures of commercialization of sport. I'm thinking, for instance, of the game that's now called netball. We used to call that basketball in Australia, and it was a girls' sport. And it was not just for girls in school, but was a mass participation sport for young adults too. Not anymore. Because commercialized forms of sport have taken over to a quite extraordinary extent. But it then, you know, poses a problem for the managers of commercial sporting codes, how to make their sports respectable, if you like, in gender terms, given associations between lesbianism and sporting prowess from earlier periods of history, or which are still present in the culture. Those organizational dilemmas are fascinating to watch and somewhat horrifying to watch, partly because I think that is one of the things that has driven an increasing insistence on sharp segregation between women and men in sport, which of course has, you know, destroyed the career of Caster Semenya, and has brought a weird kind of sex testing into one sport after another. So fascinating tangles there that the attempt to enforce a particular gender order creating, you know, hybrid forms of femininity.
So I definitely want to return to this question that you raised of kind of segregation and exclusion, because that's really today, right? If we're thinking about in the sociology of sport more broadly, that this is one of the most fundamental challenges really we're confronted with in forms of inequality and exploitation that are shaping the world of sport. But before we get to that darker but necessary note, I do think we should also speak to the fact that with respect to women's sport, we are in a moment of really a remarkable explosion of popularity. And as you've put, I like how you've put it, commercialized sport, right? And you're making a distinction between mass sport, commercial sport, and you're absolutely right. Like what we tend to talk on this show about capitalist sport from a very critical perspective. So I take your comments extremely well. But nonetheless, again, in North America, we're seeing this massive growth of women's sport in terms of popularity. I'm not sure the extent to which that's true in Australia. I'm just less familiar with the context. But one example in North America is the birth of a new professional hockey league called the PWHL, which has done extremely impressive numbers in terms of spectatorship recently, really exceeding the expectations that league itself had. How have you read this welcome and much needed growth in the popularity of women's commercial sport?
Yeah, I'm not the expert you want on this, because there are people who are directly studying those issues in Australia. Look, the same kind of thing has happened, though the configuration, of course, is different. It doesn't. What we call hockey is field hockey, so we don't have what you would call hockey. And I remember a wonderful book from a good many years back, one of the first significant pieces I ever read on sport, gender and masculinity was a book which I'm sure you know called Hockey Night in Canada, that opened up a lot of these issues for me. In Australia, we've had a decline in the older forms of mass participation sport for women. So tennis was another one, where there would be public tennis courts in every country town in Australia. Women would be at least half of the players. That is almost gone as a mass participation sport. Netball, not quite gone, but by no means as popular as it was. But at the same time, women's football has become significant in two codes. One is the code which only we have, called Australian Rules Football, which used to be played principally in the state of Victoria, but is now a national commercial sport. That was exclusively a men's game. Just in very recent years, a new league has been founded under the auspices of the Men's League, women's Australian Football League, and that was founded in the teeth of a great deal of objection and protest from masculinist sports commentators, I might say. It was quite funny to watch. And has established itself not spectacularly in terms of spectatorship, but has, I believe, been at least a moderate commercial success. But the truly interesting thing is the Australian women's soccer team, the national team, known as the Matildas, after the song which failed to become the Australian national anthem, although it was Australia's favourite song, called Waltzing Matilda, a song about a sheep thief. Anyway, the Australian women's soccer team, known as the Matildas, has been doing very well in international competition, because that's deeply embarrassing, because Australian men's soccer doesn't do well at all. And the Matildas have now become a minor cultural icon, possibly on the way to becoming a major one. It's very, very funny, and are getting enormous publicity. So it's a somewhat unpredictable thing, but I think it reflects, you know, long feminist campaigns over, you know, a generation and a half to contest the more gross forms of gender segregation and exclusion. That is now paying off, curiously, in commercial sport, where I would never have predicted it would happen. But there you are.
Well, yes. And speaking of segregation and exclusion, that's been one of the issues that we've been most concerned with, horrified by on this podcast, the massive surge in trans exclusion policies we've seen in the world of women's sport. I mean, and this is, again, I'm not sure exactly how it has manifested in Australia, in North America. We have seen, especially in the United States, but it's spread to Canada, where I am as well. Actually, my province of New Brunswick has been on the, I'm sad to say, really on the front lines of disseminating anti-trans policy more broadly, and also in the context of sport, so that we see all these bans on trans participation in sport as a kind of commonsensical way. And I put that in scare quotes, because I think there's nothing correct about it, but nonetheless, it draws on certain commonsensical notions about masculine superiority in the context of sport. And so I think a lot of politicians who are trying to advance these transphobic policies have used sport, weaponized sport in order to advance their own aims, and at the cost of the people who deserve the ability to participate in sport in the spaces that are correct for them. I'd be fascinated to get your perspective as a lifelong gender studies scholar on how we should understand these trans exclusion policies and their putative relationship to feminism, which is the other side of this, right? We go, the one side is the sort of fascist project that we're getting, and on the other side is this so-called, in the name of feminism, defense of these policies.
Well, you've laid it out, I think, pretty well. There has long been a small faction in feminism which has been hostile to trans women. That goes back to the 1970s, when there was an attempt, if you like, to purify feminism by means of exclusion. And that had, you know, some effect. It certainly drove a kind, because other groups of feminists, few of them, were actually worried about trans people at all. So the only feminist group who were making much of a noise about it were the anti-trans faction. Things have sort of blown up more recently, I think largely because significant groups of men have also climbed on an anti-trans bandwagon. They include religious figures. There's a far-right network in the Catholic Church which has pushed anti-trans ideas. There are right-wing groups in party politics. We're most familiar, I guess, with those policies coming out of the current right wing of the Republican Party in the United States, but those things have also happened elsewhere, as you say. And also, I think there are, if you like, commercial interests involved now. Since the world of organized sport on a global scale has very largely been taken over by corporate interests, the maintenance of rigid gender divisions is, I think, can be understood partly as part of a marketing strategy of the corporations, the corporate interests involved, and part of their defensive strategies to protect themselves against regulation by governments or the intrusion of the complexities of the world into the very stylized and rigidly controlled world of competitive sport. Beyond that, I don't know that I have much insight to give. The power here is in the hands of groups of men, overwhelmingly. Most feminists, I'm pretty sure, would support trans inclusion in almost any circumstances. That's been clear for a good long time. But the corporate media, of course, like the fact that there are some feminists who are anti-trans and can be relied on to produce the scare clips or quotations that are wanted for the scare stories. Sad but true.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And really that brings me to the next thing, which is, as you say, most feminists, the vast majority of feminists understand how problematic these anti-trans policies are, and in fact are the leading advocates for trans inclusion. And of course, that means that gender studies, which is sort of the site, of course, of this kind of scholarship in the academy, this kind of feminist scholarship, has also itself been under attack, right, from similar institutions, because it is seen as a profound threat by the very kind of men, the fascist stakeholders and so forth, who are trying to reinscribe a very traditional patriarchal regime. And so in recent years, we've witnessed, you know, somewhat of a crisis, honestly, in global neoliberal hegemony, right? But we've also witnessed an attendant rise in fascism across the world, which makes sense. The crisis for neoliberalism is an opportunity for fascism, just as capitalist crises are always openings for fascism. And one of the key strategies of this iteration of fascism, certainly in North America, has been the particular scapegoating and demonization of trans people in particular. And therefore, and an associated way, gender studies, right, is what is perceived to be the academic space that legitimizes the presence or the existence of trans people. So-called public intellectuals like Canada's own monstrosity, Jordan Peterson, have very deliberately attempted to foment at minimum, and I say like at the very minimum, rhetorical violence against the field of gender studies. And this manifested in Canada this past summer at Waterloo University with a gender studies professor who was stabbed in the classroom for these very ideological reasons. Could you appraise for us the place of gender studies in the current conjuncture, its political, intellectual, and ethical significance today?
Yeah, I think you're right to say we're facing something of a crisis here, or at least a developing crisis, and that while issues about trans men and women or non-binary people are often, you know, at the rhetorical centre, this is broader. This is much broader. The anti-trans stuff comes in context of anti-gay, anti-abortion, anti-women's rights kind of agitation, and in, you know, some of the epicenters of this, like the online manosphere, or in the online manifestos of the guys who carry out mass shootings, one of whom, of course, was of the worst, was done by an Australian over in New Zealand. It's not enough, I guess, to stand pat. There has to be consideration, as your question suggests, of what's the, if you like, the point or the larger place of gender studies now. And I think the case for gender studies is that, you know, deny it or not, gender is an important dimension of human life. It's one of the things that makes us human. And just banning the study of it, which has happened, of course, in Hungary under the authoritarian nationalist regime there, doesn't remove its significance in our lives. It just makes it harder to understand and deal with. It's also a case that gender is, you know, has always been a site of struggle and contestation. We can go back to the European Middle Ages and we'll find active debates about gender issues, about, for instance, the nature of women and their threat to the souls of men, and defences of women by both by men and by women, intellectuals and theologians. I mean, contestation around these things is nothing new, and it's not a bad thing in itself. What becomes, I think, deeply worrying is when this ceases to be any kind of debate that can go anywhere and becomes principally an arena for the display of violence and repression, whether that is, you know, in the form of shooting or in the form of legislation, court action or whatever. We can quote Shakespeare, we can quote the Bible, we can quote Goethe. The important texts of our culture are full of ideas and discussions around gender. It is really quite a mainstream, important matter for understanding, study, and reflection. And the attack on having that as part of a higher education, I think, is really, you know, an attempt to push human understanding backwards and backwards a long way. We can do better than that. We should do better than that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Beautifully said. You're absolutely right. And in this moment of insurgent fascism and nationalism around the globe, which we're seeing in so many sites, sport has and has often had, right, an important role to say. We play. We know that in Nazi Germany, right, sport had a the spectacle of the Olympics, for instance, had a tremendous role in terms of normalizing, legitimizing that regime. And I would say probably this moment is no different. Would you say that sport has an important role to play in the resurgence of authoritarianism in global politics today?
I don't know that it's played a leading role. That role of legitimating authoritarianism, yes. Remember Putin's Winter Olympics. That role can still be played. What is perhaps a deeper significance is the role that that stylized and rule-bound sport plays in accustoming people in their bodies to hard discipline, harsh discipline, and to the presentation of triumph achieved in competition against other bodies, overcoming other bodies. This creates a certain way of imagining the world. And the combination of the force and skill that goes into competitive sports, whether they're games, whether individual disciplines, I think does have a role in accustoming large populations to the imposition of discipline, to the unthoughtful, conformity to rules and so forth. That I see as part of the cultural base out of which authoritarian politics arises. So I'd see sport as playing more of a background role and playing it in a changing way, of course, as mass participation sports decline, the symbolic competition and symbolic discipline of media, mediated sports becomes more central to people's senses of themselves, their nationality, and so forth. So it undoubtedly has cultural and political impacts. Not all pushing towards fascism, but certainly towards discipline, authoritarianism, and celebration of nationhood, which are easily appropriated by authoritarian and fascist movements.
Yes. Okay, so we've covered a ton of ground here, really, but I want to finish by asking you, at this stage of your career, as you survey the fields of gender studies, masculinity, and the sociology of sport, what would you say are the most crucial directions or avenues for future research and scholarship? And more broadly, and this is really, it's a different question, and it potentially opens its own can of worms, and I'm happy to go there too. But I'm also curious, how optimistic are you more generally about the future of the academy itself or higher education?
Okay, well, my little list of directions for the field of gender studies, masculinity, and with particular focus in the sociology of sport would be these. I think, as I did say earlier, crucial issues now concern global power, global inequality, the long-term consequences of empire and colonialism, and the way those play out in a field like global commercial sport, I think is intensely interesting, very important. So head there, including, possibilities of contestation. Like, if you you know, if you're making one of these lists of the greatest sports figures in the last 350 years or something, well, of course, quite a number of people coming from the global south would be there. It's not all a one-dimensional story of global north domination. Secondly, I think that there's important and really interesting work to be done developing good practice and good policy for sports and for recreational use of the body more generally. Non-competitive but still fascinating and interesting games, for instance, as a form of pedagogy. I know there's really interesting work on that. I'd like to see it developed on a larger scale. Then a topic we've already touched on, studying the commercialization of sport. What difference does it make when a sport is organized in the form of a corporation as a profit-making enterprise? What are the effects of that on the sport itself, on the participants, the players, on the audiences too? And finally, as some of my career in education department, some of my research career studying children and teenagers, I think there's lots to be done around the study of children's play, children's embodiment, school sport, and how that can be developed in more humane and still interesting ways. So those are where I'd like to see the field go. As far as the university in general goes, well, you'll excuse my moment of commercialization. I have written a book about this. It's called The Good University, and it tries to do what the title says, not just try to analyze how universities are working and lament the toxic changes that have been produced by commercialization in universities, because it's happened there too, but also to retrieve the rich history of alternative forms of higher education, because there is actually an amazing history of labor colleges, anti-colonial universities, underground universities, free universities, popular science research projects, and so on. There's a rich history we can draw on to imagine better ways of doing higher education and debate what are the real criteria, you know, beyond those really silly league tables. What are the real criteria for a good university that serves the society, that advances knowledge, that is a good place for people to work in, and that has a reviving effect on the rest of the education system? That's what I think a good university should be doing.
Absolutely. And that is certainly the university that we all should be aspiring to and that we all deserve, because too often the universities that we see, around the world, honestly, it's like, I want to say North America, that's the context I'm most familiar with, but I know that this is not just a North American problem, that we see increasingly the commercialized university, the managerial university, the precarious university, right, that doesn't benefit those who work in the space, and it doesn't benefit the students who often have to pay increasing amounts of money in order to get access to the space. That's not the university that any of us deserve. So you're pointing us to, I think, a much, much better model, and I hope we can find a way there. Raylan Connell, thank you so much for your time today. It has been an absolute tremendous pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.